Welcome to The Good, The Bad, and The Science, the show that breaks down the science of television and movies with a comedian and a scientist. Today we're discussing Zootopia, so I'll ask about bunnies, foxes, and politically corrupt sheep. But first, a short word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
The good, the bad, and the science.
Television, movies, comedians, and scientists.
The good, the bad, and the science.
Hi everyone, I'm your host Ethan Edinburgh, and I've got two wonderful guests joining me today. Our first guest is a professor of psychology at UCLA, and because he's a waterfall of knowledge, we've had him on previous episodes like The Lion King, Black Mirror, and Memento. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Aaron the Blaze Blaisdell.
Thanks, Ethan. It's great to be back.
It's great to see you, Blaze. I hope I can call you that during the episode. And
that's fine.
Not upset you. Purple Blaze, but you've got a symposium coming up, I saw, and you did not invite me to speak. Is that correct?
That is an oversight on my part. Yes, we have the Ancestral Health Symposium, the 10-year anniversary. It was born at UCLA. It's been around the country. It's coming back to UCLA for the 10th anniversary, and we do have a packed house of speakers, but there was no room left for you. I'm so sorry. You know what?
Wow.
You can come to the after party.
Oh, okay. I might take you up on that. That sounds actually really fun. So yeah, we'll get more on that information later, but I have to introduce our second guest. Is that okay?
Go for it.
Okay, thank you, Blaze. Our second guest is a stand-up comedian and writer who has appeared on Conan, Bring the Funny, and much more. I'm thrilled to have him on the show. Welcome, Michael Longfellow.
Hey, thank you for having me, Ethan.
Hey, thanks for being here, Michael. I don't know if you watch basketball, but I know you're from Phoenix, so I have to gauge your excitement level about the Suns right now.
Very excited. I do watch basketball, and I love the Suns, and we're making a real run.
Yes, I'm also very excited and have been rooting for that team for years, actually, even though I'm from Miami, weirdly. But anyways, now that live shows are back, I hope that we run into each other sometime in LA, and we can talk about the Suns and all my secret, controversial, too hot for the podcast thoughts on Zootopia.
Yeah, I would love that. I had no idea that you rooted for the Suns. That's amazing.
I mean, I think everybody should be, at least, for Chris Paul. He's worked really hard for a long time.
It's an easy team to, it's an easy team to root for.
Yeah, come on. And the jerseys look cool. What's not to love?
What's not to love?
Seriously. Okay, so Zootopia, guys. This was the first time that I had seen this movie, but I want to find out from you. Let's start with Michael. Had you seen this before, or was this your first time?
I've seen the DMV sloth scene before, okay. But I'd never seen the movie.
And what did you think about the movie?
I thought it was crazy. there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I agree.
Lots to unpack.
I mean, would you recommend it to a friend? Did you think it was fun?
Yeah, I thought it was a good, like a cute movie. I definitely recommend it to a friend or a friend's child.
Or an enemy, even.
But I'd also recommend it to anybody, because I think there's a lot going on under the scenes, behind the scenes.
Yeah, I would agree. What about you, Blaze? Was this your first time seeing Zootopia?
No, actually, it's my third time. When I watched it yesterday, I watched it in the theater when it first came out. I bought the DVD and I watched it again with the kids, with the family. And I had actually, confession here, I'm a little bit biased because I was a consultant on the film.
Whoa! Consulting on Zootopia, Blaze?
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome.
Byron Howard had called me in, the director of the film. And they do this. Disney really, especially under John Lasseter's leadership, they really started doing a lot of R&D for every film or TV show that they make. And I got in their Rolodex somehow, and I started getting called in on various projects.
Wow.
And Zootopia was the first one, and it was really fun to see the building of it as it was, like, from its infancy, really.
Yeah, so what was that process like? I mean, did they bring you in, and did they show you drawings and say, do paws look like this, or what?
Yeah, it's sort of like that. I mean, they bring you into their the big, you know, in Burbank they have this their site, and also they have a site for where all the directors and the production team works, and has a big hat like in that Mickey mm-hmm. Mouse film. Yeah, so they call you in there. You sit in a big boardroom with some of the writers, artists, sketch people, and a director. And they have on the walls all of the, like, early stage drawings of what they think the characters, the main characters might look like, what the world's going to look like, you know, the sketches. And then they start taking you through the storyline, kind of what they have formed at the time, and but also pitching what the ideas are. And then for every kind of expert they consult with, they're consulting for a specific reason. In my case, it was obviously the animal behavior, you know, rabbits and foxes, and how would they all work if they're, like, human-like and living in a city together? How would they interact? Things like that.
Interesting. Okay, so did you provide, like, do you recall any information or advice that you gave them that you then saw in the movie?
It's hard to see specific things, but I feel like the movie, they captured a lot of the kinds of relationships between animals that I've talked about. And it's known. It's not like I was the only expert to know that predators and prey have these certain dynamic with each other, right? These certain kinds of relationships, that there's a balance there. And so they obviously put that in the story, building up the backstory of where they came from. And now they're no longer like that. And they live in harmony, kumbaya kind of thing. And they were saying that that's, like, what they were talking to me about. It was like, you know, what are going to be the ways that the different animals might need to interact? And it, so no specific thing to answer your question, but just the overall feel felt, you know, honest and capturing what we had talked about.
Awesome. Okay, well, I loved this movie, so great work to you. I assume basically by consulting, you also wrote it and did all the voices. So just my hat is off. I thought it was great fun.
All the errors are my fault.
Yeah, and we're going to get into it. No, I didn't even... nothing super struck me as, like, errors, you know, like when we do kind of a more realistic space movie and all of a sudden you hear a bunch of noise in outer space or something. But it did just spark a bunch of questions while I was watching it, including the beginning. So the movie starts out with, like, the animals doing a play and a tiger is attacking a bunny. And so, you know, it's a science podcast. I gotta ask the hard-hitting questions here. Do tigers eat bunnies?
To my knowledge, no.
Okay.
Because they don't tend to live in the same areas with each other. I think even there, tigers wouldn't find much of a meal out of a bunny.
Okay. It would be, it's like an appetizer.
Larger prey. Yeah. They wouldn't waste their time, you know.
Okay. That's good to know. So we don't have to imagine tigers eating bunnies for the rest of this podcast. So that's nice. But she does become friends with a fox, but they are predators, as they say in the movie many times. So do foxes eat bunnies?
Foxes do eat bunnies. So they did play that up correctly. And that was, it's part of what they were asking me about in the consult, was that dynamic. And they're going to be partners in this film, and, like, how might that play out, that old history play out. And so, yes, they are natural predator prey.
Okay. Is there kind of, like, classic moves that the, you know, do the bunnies have any sort of defense? I would think that they're quick, their speed might get them out of a fox's mouth, but foxes are very fast as well, no?
Yes, foxes do try and ambush silently. It's to their benefit because if they're going after a rabbit, it would be a kind of prey that can run away quickly if they're caught too soon or discovered too soon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so prey animals like bunnies mostly are hunted by visual predators. So wolves and foxes are both, they use scent as well to locate prey, but then to chase down and catch the prey, they're using vision to a large extent, as well as birds of prey, like owls and hawks also are visual foragers for the most part. And so these kind of prey, like rodents and rabbits, have these different natural defenses that get engaged when they detect that there might be a predatory threat nearby. And it depends on how imminent that threat is. If it's they think there's some kind of prey or predator nearby, what they generally do is freeze. So they stop all movement, try and hold as still as possible. The only noticeable movement you can see if you're watching them is the chest moving from breathing. But you know, other than that, they're not moving. And that's because the visual predators are looking, they're detecting prey based on motion. Mm. So you've ever had a cat and you have like a, you dangle something in front of it, or you shoot a laser point on the wall and the cats are like just watching it. And wherever you jerk the laser point or the item, they jerk it and they watch it, they track it. And mm-hmm. they're really drawing attention to motion. Now, once the predator gets close enough, it's about to strike at the prey. That's when they usually will then stop freezing and they'll book it, they'll run. And that's the rabbit's best defense.
Okay, got it. That makes a lot of sense. And I will say, I'm not a scientist, of course, but I do have two cats. And I did read that when you play with a laser pointer with cats, they love it, but you can't just end the game because they get frustrated, like they didn't catch anything. So you have to kind of like hide food while they don't see you and then bring the laser pointer to that little treat and then turn the laser pointer off. And that way they feel like, okay, I'm satisfied.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I've had cats and I've done the laser point game and often didn't end it that way. But I would end it by petting them and giving them comfort of some kind. So I didn't leave them too stressed out at the end.
Okay. I still think you're a monster, Blaze. But, you know, we don't have time to get into your psychology, unfortunately. Michael, have you ever been hunting or eaten rabbits? I know people eat that.
I don't think I've ever eaten rabbits. And I've never been hunting.
Okay, good, same.
So I wish I had more, but no. I do. I will say I have a friend that has a laser thing that he leaves on at night for the cat, and his cat is mentally ill and sick. And
no.
I think that has a lot to do with it, because it's just, it's a never-ending torture of trying to catch something that can't be caught.
Jesus.
Worst cat I know.
Do you know if the cat had these types of issues before he started using?
I don't.
Okay.
I met him when he was already
too far gone.
Pretty crazy. Yeah, too far gone.
Wow.
A lost cause.
Damn. I feel like that's even a I don't know, like immoral thing to sell. Cat company,
you know,
big cat.
Not my place. However, however you want to own your cat. I mean, be good.
Yeah, but in our research, it shows
it's right on the line of where I don't feel comfortable being like, I don't think that's, you know, maybe you should turn that off.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and take that stance because according to my research, 100% of stories that I've heard involving all night lasers have turned cats crazy.
I have to tell them this. It'd be irresponsible of me not to.
Yeah, please.
Do they at least play Pink Floyd music to go with the laser show?
He doesn't. Oh, it's silent chaos.
Oh my god, so cruel. Okay, so I have to ask what the deal is with rabbits and carrots. Like there's a ton of carrot jokes in this movie. There's, you know, the rabbit's parents are carrot farmers. So can you explain, like, do rabbits just really love carrots? Is it a major part of their diet? Do they have to live near a carrot farm? How does this all work?
Yeah, where did that meme get started?
Yeah.
To my knowledge, carrots are not a major natural food source for rabbits. They tend to eat leafy greens that are above ground, and carrots are a below ground, you know, storage organ for the plant. So they will dig up a garden to get at those things, and that's where I think the idea gets started with humans growing carrots and turnips and those kind of things. The rabbits get into the gardens. They're eating down to the leafy greens, but they're also then digging up and going after the other things underground, like turnips and carrots and stuff. And I don't think it's a major part of a wild rabbit's diet, though.
Wow. Okay, so this is just, you know, propaganda that's gotten out of control.
I can't believe that.
Well, I mean, Bugs Bunny was always shown with a carrot in his mouth, right?
So. Yeah, but so I assume, and maybe I'm wrong here, that that was already a stereotype or like a common, you know, joke.
Exactly.
Right, even before that.
Yep. Yeah. Going way back. And I guess, again, because of farming. Farming goes way back in, among humankind. So, you know, think of in England, and there are tons of rabbits in the UK. You go out to a farm, and they're always putting fences up to keep rabbits out. They have to get the fences down in the ground so that the rabbits can dig under the fence and get into the garden. So this tension between farmers and the rabbits, so I think that's where the idea about the carrot, you know, and rabbits going together comes from.
See, it's amazing to me that it's so well known, incorrectly, improperly, that they love carrots, and yet I never hear about them digging holes underground. That's fascinating.
Well, I don't know a lot about it. I just know that they make warrens. There's a great book, Watership Down. I don't know if you ever read it. They made it into a really violent movie because it's actually kind of violent scenes in the book of rabbit warfare.
Whoa.
Rabbit on rabbit violence.
Oh my God.
It's an allegory type of story told with rabbits as the characters. But the guy who wrote it, Richard Adams, did a lot of research among people, talking to a lot of people who knew about rabbits, like rabbit biologists, and there are such a thing, and got his facts straight. And so it really, they do dig. They're really good at digging. They can tunnel a few feet in a day easily. And so, yeah, wow. It's a great way for them to both escape predators, escape getting, be safe, a safe place to raise their young, and to get past those pesky fences.
Wow, fascinating. And I guess foxes do a similar thing, right? Isn't there a foxhole is like a...
I don't know if foxes are as good at digging as rabbits or if they use already existing holes. That's a good question. I don't have the background on that.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So maybe rabbits have the upper hand there with the digging. They can get out of danger. Okay, so this is a silly one, but there's so many different types of animals in this movie, and they, like you said, are like living in this big city and doing a lot of kind of human activities, including what they eat. There's cops, which are, you know, rhinos and the like, and they're eating donuts and coffee and stuff like that. And so I have to ask if animals can have these treats.
They will eat them if you give them to them. If there's an opportunity for a wildebeest to eat a donut, it probably would.
Okay, but not healthy for this wildebeest, I would imagine?
It would not be healthy for them. Just like it's not healthy for us. It's probably even less healthy for them.
I mean, yeah, I just visited home. I was in Miami, and my mom has a dog, and she let the dog lick the remains of her acai bowl.
Oh, yeah.
And I was quite alarmed by that. And she was like, no, it's fine. It's just fruit or whatever.
Not that fine.
Okay. I'm glad I have this on the record. So dogs should not have acai bowls. Is that what you're telling me?
That's what I'm saying. No donuts, no ice cream. My grandmother used to give her poodle ice cream.
Why is it worse for animals than it is for us, you think?
Well, I don't know if it's that much worse for them, except that they're smaller. They don't have a history. Humans at least have a history of some sort of eating kind of these processed foods. Mm-hmm. And primates have a better ability to break down sugar that comes from fruit, and therefore the really massive amount of sugar in ice cream and an acai bowl would, I think, we're a little bit better able to handle that than an animal that's more from a predatory background.
Okay, that makes sense. So yeah, like evolutionarily, we have experience digesting that stuff and they don't, so who knows what it's gonna do to them.
Yeah, it's like a spectrum. I mean, we're further along the spectrum of it being somewhat doable without being too much long-term harm. But of course, it's easy to fall off that spectrum.
And you're, it sounds like you're kind of anti ice cream, anti donuts. Is that correct?
Those are two of my favorite desserts, but yeah, I don't eat them really, except on a real occasional treat, because I just know how it messes me up. So, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. You have a favorite ice cream flavor? Gotta ask. It's law. That's the law.
Yes, of course I do. Chocolate mint.
Wow. Okay. Also mine, Michael.
Rocky Road.
Rocky Road. Wow. That's a rare one.
That's a rare one.
Well, just when asking people.
That's Mount Rushmore. I mean, that's a classic.
Don't get me wrong. I'm all about Rocky Road. I just rarely hear that response to favorite ice cream flavor.
I may have just said the first thing that came to mind.
You may have. Who else should I ask?
Neapolitan. Now that I think about it more.
Okay, that makes sense. What about donuts? I feel like, and this is maybe just my mind going crazy right now, but here in LA especially, there's like a donut shop every street. There's just, it's like,
I've noticed that
some of them are just called donuts.
Yeah,
too. They don't like have a real name.
No, correct. I don't know how they list, how they got incorporated. But yeah, there's donut shops everywhere, and they're also so cheap, and so I'm so curious how these things stay in business. It's like baffling to me.
It's like pizza shops in New York City.
Yeah,
you know, just one in every corner and cheap.
Yeah, don't they just fill their dumpster at the end of the night with donuts that no one ate, hundreds of
donuts. They must, right?
And that's why they have a lot of rats.
Yeah, but the rats aren't paying the bills.
No.
Very strange to me. Okay, to find out exactly how the rats do pay the bills, I'm going to ask that question right after this break.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the streaming wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
So we're back and we're talking about the economy of rats. I do want to, there were rats in this movie. Some of my favorite parts were with the rats, actually. And for example,
maybe they were
mice. Am I wrong about that? Mm.
That little town?
There's like a little rodent town, and then there's like mafia rats or mafia mice.
Mr. Big.
Were not, as far as I can understand, those were not rats.
Oh.
Those were like, what was it? Like a vole or a shrew, I think.
Okay, very cool. I did not know that. Do they live in the tundra? Because I believe that all took place in Tundra Town, and I was a little surprised to see that kind of rodent, in the snow.
Yes, they do. In fact, I was in Buffalo a couple years ago, and I saw voles hanging out, you know, where normally in the wintertime it would have been all snowy. This was summertime. So I know that those northern climates have a lot of these real small voles and shrews and things like that.
Do you know if they're often involved in organized crime? Like this movie tells us.
I really avoid them, so I don't know.
Okay, that makes sense. Doesn't eat ice cream, doesn't mess with rat mafia. mafia, excuse me. I don't want to appear speciesist. Speaking of the climate, I love how in the same, I don't know, city, I guess, there's like really diverse ecosystems that are in very close proximity. And although I thought that was very cool, I thought this is probably unrealistic, but maybe I'm wrong. I hope that I'm wrong. Are there like really diverse ecosystems really close to each other on the planet?
Not that I'm aware of, except at zoos where they artificially create such a situation to some extent.
Mm.
Obviously, even at a zoo, you go where like the polar bears are. It's not as cold as like really snowing. But they do at zoos. They'll attempt to try and maintain something that's approximate for the species in a particular area. And since they have species from all different climes, they do some job towards doing that. Obviously, in the movie, they had figured this out to a mega scale.
Right.
There must be a science behind it, that city construction. And actually, Byron Howard told me that the previous person he had consulted with was actually somebody was interested. He was interested in figuring out how do you get all the different animals from elephants and giraffe size down to shrew and bull and mouse size to interact in a city together. Mm-hmm. And so he had consulted with somebody who's an expert in fractals, and he designed a city based on this fractal layout of, big scales and smaller scales replicating so that they can interact.
Wow. Yeah, that was awesome. I mean, it's I don't care who you are. Really entertaining to see all these animals together going to work. And I have to actually ask, there's not a zoo in the traditional form, but it is called Zootopia. And zoos are, across the board, somewhat terrible. Everybody kind of agrees. But then there's always an asterisk, and there's always like, well, but also, if it wasn't for the zoo that I went to when I was 8, I wouldn't have become a scientist and done all this amazing work, et cetera, et cetera. So do you fall somewhere on the spectrum, or are you just like categorically against zoos?
Good question. And when I was a kid, I absolutely loved zoos. In fact, I wanted to work at a zoo. That was like my dream job when I was a little boy, because I loved animals. I just really loved them. So I loved being at zoos. As I got older, I realized that the conditions they're kept in often are not very good. They're either socially isolated or they're very bare conditions. And the animals will show signs of distress in those kind of situations. They pace, they might pluck at their fur. They don't look happy and they look depressed.
Right.
But I remember when I was in college reading in the science section of the New York Times, somebody was covering the fact that the Bronx Zoo had just changed the habitat that the rhinos were in, such that it was much larger, a lot more space for them to hide in. And the same, I think they were doing the same with the gorilla enclosure. And some people were complaining because they couldn't see the animals. But, of course, they were doing it because it was a much more natural setting for the animal. Then a lot of their problem behaviors, abnormal behaviors, went away. They started acting more like calm and seemed happier. So, and there's been a movement, at least since the 80s, for zoos doing that. You see a lot of zoos, like the LA Zoo here, it's a lot better situation. Of course, it's not like the real thing, but it is getting better. And so I do feel it's okay, as long as we're really trying our best to be good stewards of the situation of these captive animals.
Speaking of you remembering something that you read in the New York Times from college, I have a bad memory, and it's plagues me. I'm always concerned that I'm forgetting stuff. There's a quote in the movie. They say elephants remember everything. That's kind of like with the carrots and the rabbits. Like, we've heard this a million times, that an elephant never forgets. Yep. So yeah, I mean, I can't remember my fourth grade teacher's name or where I left my phone charger. So what's the deal with elephant's memory?
Well, there are two answers to that question. Of course, I'm a scientist, so I have to have multiple answers to what seems like a simple question on the face of it. And again, it's an excellent question. One, they don't have better memories than other animals, as far as we can tell, in terms of the types of different memories systems that they might have. But I'll follow that by saying they're a very long-lived species, and they seem to have retained memories from when they were young all the way through to old age. And since that can span many decades, therefore the memories can last decades. And so in that sense, yeah, they have really long-lasting memories, but that's probably because they're very long-lasting individuals in terms of their lifespan.
Would you say it's similar to the carrot-rabbit fascination propaganda?
Yeah. I would say it's overblown.
Overblown. Man, yeah. We are disposing of myths here today.
Well, and that the makers of Zootopia actually showed that elephant did not have such a great memory after all.
That's true. I did enjoy that bit. A great joke there. So a lot of animals in this movie are walking on 2 feet that normally do not. Was that discussed in your consultations, or was that just a decision like, okay, we're going in, let's not question this? And then of course I have to ask, like, are there animals that like do that? I've seen, you know, videos of bears where they get on 2 feet for a little while. So yeah, why do they do that? And why did we start doing that?
They actually did explain, they did say they made that choice to do the human, you know, human-like, anthropomorphized animals. But they said they wanted to make it believable. They wanted to make it so that the, and they discussed it with me, and it seemed very valid. And as a little backstory, Byron Howard's favorite Disney film when he was growing up, he told me, was The Jungle Book.
Oh yeah.
And he's always wanted to make a movie in that same vein of like animals that are talking and interacting with each other and with people, maybe, although in Zootopia it's just the mammals. Mm-hmm. So he kind of wanted that. That was the genre of the film he was going for. And, you know, there's a certain amount of believability of fantasy that we buy into. And to me, I thought that was fine. I even said, yeah, that sounds fine to me.
Great.
Oh, and so do animals do the, in a, actually do this kind of bipedal locomotion, as it's known? And as you said, bears will get on their hind legs. They don't walk too much on their hind legs, but they will get and stand, and so they could see further or look more intimidating if they're threatened. There are some primates that will occasionally get on their hind legs and walk short distances. Chimpanzees, if they're carrying something, can do that.
Oh.
Gibbons, you know, the kind of ape that swings from branches, these really long arms, and their shoulder just pivots like 180.
Whoa.
As they're swinging. They're like monkey bar type swinging. Those are called gibbons. They're a type of ape that lives in Southeast Asia.
Hmm.
And when they do go to the ground, they can't walk quadrupedally on all fours. They have to actually walk on two legs and hold their arms out to the sides.
Whoa.
Looks kind of comical.
Okay, interesting. These gibbons are similar to us and jacked, sounds like. More jacked.
Oh, upper body, for sure. Their lower body, not so much. But yeah, their upper body is strong.
They've forgotten leg day.
Basically.
Yeah.
And humans started walking over 5 million years ago. So early on in the split from the other great apes, when the hominid line that led to humans, bipedality was one of the first changes, one of the first adaptations to being human. The large brains came much later, actually.
Was there a evolutionary reason for it? Was it, you know, a survival mechanism or something?
Right. There must be an evolutionary reason for it. There's still some debate about what that is, because it's very tough to test that idea. And we have fossil evidence for the fact that they were walking bipedally.
Okay.
But to know what was the cause. And one of the best scenarios that seems to be the biggest consensus in the field of paleoanthropology, the study of ancient humans, is that with the change in the climate, and this is in Africa, was becoming very dry about 7-8 million years ago, and forests were shrinking, and grasslands and savannas were getting larger, a larger part of the African continent. And so the space that the more chimp or gorilla orangutan-like ape, the forest apes, were living in was getting smaller. And so some apes might have ventured out into more open woodland and savanna-type environments. And there, to stand up above the level of the grass, because grass is not like what a mowed lawn. We're talking about like really tall grass that's almost as up to our chin.
Wow.
For us. So if they're standing bipedally, they can look further, see maybe potential predators like cheetahs and lions.
Ooh.
And they might be able to carry things and locomote bipedally and carry things with them. So like stone tools. They think that those two things kind of go hand in hand, pun intended. Hand and foot, maybe, I don't know, stone tools and walking bipedally. So that's the best story so far.
Got you. Okay, that makes sense to me. Michael, you believe in evolution or no?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, cool.
I don't know any other good ones. That one seems like the best, most reasonable to me.
Yeah, the other popular one has to do something with God, and he made Adam and Eve, and that was like...
Yeah, and that's a fun one too, you know, and I spend my time with that as a boy, but I just think the evolution one, it's easier to grasp.
Yeah, yeah, same here. There was a point where Judy Hopps, our main rabbit bunny character.
Dirty cop, by the way.
Dirty cop? You're calling her out?
She is a, she's going off her beat to fulfill her own agenda. She's an opportunist, and I think she should have her badge taken away.
Oh, oh my Lord.
Absolutely. She got lucky. She stumbled into something bigger than herself.
Yeah. And she got bailed out. I mean, let's call it what it is.
But you're the way, right. The way she plays the game, it's problematic.
Yeah, yeah. She definitely also used her size to her advantage because she like related with the sheep politician who, you know, told her like, "Oh, you're on this case now." She was about to be fired.
That's true. And look who that turned out to be. You know,
exactly.
The enemy in the end.
Yeah, yeah. She was making friends with the enemy early, and I agree with you. Judy Hopps, our main character, the movie should have ended 20 minutes in. She should have been fired, sent back to the farm, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Made an example of.
Classic corrupt cop story. But she says, we bunnies are good at multiplying, and this is, again, another carrot propaganda. You know, I gotta label it as such. So, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's true. Like, how good at multiplying are they? Is it because they enjoy mating more than other animals? Like, because, I mean, that's the common conception, right?
That they enjoy mating more than other animals?
Heard many jokes that, yeah, that are basically implying as much.
Hmm. Well, going at it like rabbits, you mean that kind of thing?
Right.
Yeah.
They do put out a lot. They're very productive, and all living things pretty much can experience geometric growth. So if you have 2, that'll get 4, 4 will get 8, 8 will get 16, so on and so forth, as opposed to linear growth, 1 gets 2, 2 gets 3, that kind of thing. But there's different, again, it's a spectrum. Humans are much closer to the linear side of things, although you wouldn't know by looking at, 8 billion almost now people on the planet? Mm-hmm. But we've taken away all of the evolutionary pressures, that's why. Or is it, and you have things that are much more on the, like, just pump out as many as possible and hope that some of them survive. And rabbits are a little bit closer on that side of the spectrum, especially for mammals, they're much closer to the, just, you know, play the numbers game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even in the mammal world, are they producing more than others? Like, is there a reason that we label them like this?
They're similar to rodents in that way. Rabbits are not in a rodent family, but there are like similarities in lifestyles, and including, just how many babies they'll have in a year. Because rats, mice, hamsters, they can also put out a lot. Reproduce quickly.
Gross.
I can actually contribute to this.
Oh, great.
Me and my sister each got a rabbit when we were little kids, and we didn't know that they were male and female. And before we knew it, we had like 20 rabbits.
Wow.
And then like 40 rabbits, and my mom had to basically become a person that sells rabbits.
She quit her job and
for a little
changed
while.
Into a rabbit saleswoman.
Yeah, she thought she was buying 2 rabbits.
It was a starter kit.
Yeah, it was insane. And the dad wasn't even a good dude. He would leave and we'd think he died or something, or a coyote got him. And then she would have a litter and he'd come back and he'd do it again. And then he'd bounce.
Whoa. And you guys probably made a killing.
You know, they're not as in demand as you'd think. They're pretty cost effective.
Yeah, you can kind of scoop up a rabbit for cheap. Turns
might
out.
Be a few bucks. Yeah.
Yeah.
People are really trying to get rid of them.
Right. Yeah. I think I could see why. That makes a lot of sense. Well, speaking of getting rid of them, there's something in this movie that's like turning animals savage and making them kill each other. And so if you're interested in how animals kill each other, then stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The break is over. Here we go. The show about science.
Okay, so we're talking about animal death. on the program. So animals are going savage in this movie, which actually, going back on what we said earlier, makes sense because they, you know, then they get on all fours, like throughout the whole movie, they're yeah. bipedal, like you said, and then they, you know, they become more animalistic.
Yeah, that was, I thought they captured that idea really great.
Yeah, yeah, me too. But it turns out, spoiler alert, they are eating a flower called night howlers. So I have to ask about the validity to that.
Actually, and that was another reason they brought me in, since I'm in the psychology and behavioral neuroscience faculty at UCLA. It was, in addition to my knowledge of animal behavior, they're kind of getting my knowledge of brain behavior relationships. And is it possible that there could be something that an animal eats that can have such a profound effect on their behavior? And so I guess you're dying to know the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm losing it right now.
Have you ever tried those magic mushrooms? You don't have to admit it, but do you know anybody who's
Michael's
tried
bleeding
magic
the fifth.
Mushroom?
I know a guy who knows a guy.
Yeah. So there are substances that can affect the chemicals in our brain, known as like neurotransmitters, that can affect them in ways that can have quite profound effects on our behavior. They tend not to have such a profound effect as in this movie, and not such a long-lasting, almost permanent effect. Mm-hmm. Like, they usually, substances that we ingest that can alter our state of mind, shift our behavioral systems towards something, maybe stirring up some ancestral feelings, that they wouldn't last more than the length of time it takes for them to work their way out of our system. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe hours.
Gotcha.
So it was a little bit of a stretch there, but you know, and one thing we did discuss, I remember during those discussions, was that there are, for example, viruses that can have permanent, essentially, effects on behavior that affect behavior quite a bit. And have you heard of toxoplasmosis?
No.
No.
Really? Okay.
Can't say I have.
Have you ever heard that the meme of a pregnant woman shouldn't have cats, or shouldn't clean out the cat litter?
No.
If they have a cat, if a woman's pregnant? Okay, because toxoplasmosis is carried by, I can't remember if it's a bacteria or a virus, but you could search it on Google. Toxoplasmosis. And it's basically, you can get infected with it. And what it normally does, it's cats can carry it, and it's passed on in their feces. Gross, I know. And if mice or rats somehow ingest part of it, it gets into their system, the toxoplasmosis organism goes to the brain and can make the rat or the mouse unafraid of cats, so that it makes it easier for the cat to catch and eat them, thereby completing the cycle of this parasite.
Oh my God.
And this parasite actually can change human behavior. There's evidence, good evidence, that people who have infected with toxoplasmosis are people that are more likely to do things like bungee jumping, or those kind of, maybe drive without the seatbelt on, or, you know, just like a little more risky behaviors. Oh, there actually is evidence that it has these effects, not nearly as profound as the effect it has on its natural host, which is a rodent, but even in humans it can have some effect. So even if there's not maybe a chemical like in the howler, I think they left it open to interpretation about what the actual mechanism of action would be from the flowers. Maybe it was a parasite in the flower, mm-hmm. that affected the brains of these predators. So yeah, those were the kind of things we discussed, I remember, that made it seem like, you know, it's obviously fantasy, but it's based on plausibility.
So to recap here, you're telling me if I eat my cat's crap, I might want to kill myself?
Or you wouldn't fear anybody.
Yeah, that's more likely.
What if you could eat it like before a big meeting? And then, you know, you're not afraid of the boss.
Yeah, you're not afraid to ask for that promotion.
Is it always a negative to have this parasite in your body? I would imagine so. Parasites are bad.
No, not necessarily, actually.
Here we go.
You're posing some interesting ideas here. Maybe you can get ahead. Maybe if you're
just
like,
a micro
dose, a wartime CEO. Maybe they need to have that more aggressive, uninhibited.
A stand-up comedian before a big show.
I mean, are you suggesting as an experiment that Michael, like maybe we can book two shows, right, back to back. The first show you do how you normally do, and then it...
I will volunteer
and then,
for this.
Good. I really needed your permission, so I'm glad you're down.
For science.
Yeah, it's going to help us.
I can record the data.
Yeah.
Yes. What do I sign?
Okay. The form's in the mail.
Somehow, I don't know. Like, yeah, you said like microdosing cat feces that you know has this parasite. What's wrong with that?
Nothing could go
wrong. What's wrong with it? Early show, no parasite. Late show, parasite. Yeah. And we'll see how
it goes. Don't tell the audience. And then if you get more laughs the second time, then we know that it works.
Wow. And then, you know, then I basically have my own Alpha Brain product.
Right. Yeah. Then you can sell it.
And that's huge.
What would you call this? Because you shouldn't call it kind of what it is. It could be, you know. Hey,
but definitely something far away from parasite.
But there is that coffee that's gone through a civet cat's digestive system, and then they collect the beans afterwards. Whoa. And make coffee. You've heard about that, right?
No, I have not.
Is that a bulletproof coffee?
It'll make you bulletproof. Now, it's not the same as Dave Asprey's bulletproof, but it might have the same effect. No, I just heard about this, you know? Have you not heard about
this? They feed cats coffee beans, which I assume, once again, it's bad for the cat.
I imagine it would be.
Right.
I assume this is real because I've seen it written about somewhere.
This has to be expensive.
And it is, yes.
That's Whole Foods for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, if I can interject, when I was watching yesterday, I caught a possible bloop.
Oh, here we go. Shout it out.
And I had to look this morning just to make sure that I was, you know, caught it. So, you know when the large panther went wild and was chasing them?
Yep.
And they're on that rickety bridge, mm-hmm. and, you know, she's calling, you know, the paw guy, the cheetah that mans the front desk,
right,
at the police station. And he gets the call, but right after he gets the call and she puts forward the, you know, the whatever number it is, 1011 or whatever it is, to call it distress, she drops her phone. It falls deep into wherever that they were in the jungle area, I guess it was. Then a few scenes later, they're going to that off-site facility where all the wild animals were kept. And she's using her phone as a flashlight.
My God.
And I had to close in on it. And it was the phone with the carrot on the back. He's like, instead of an apple, it's like a carrot on the back of her cell phone. It's like, oh, how did she get a new one so quickly? Because she did go and talk to that sheep woman. And the sheep woman let her use the city service to find it with the cameras to find out where they went. Right. So it was between those two scenes. Maybe she just really quickly got a backup phone somewhere. But it was like, you know, that just.
I mean, that would have been a great scene.
Yeah.
Them going to the carrot store and her buying the new.
And it's never quick. It is never quick at the carrot store.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So maybe it was in there, but it was just too long. It's a deleted scene.
More sloths.
That's in the extended version.
Yeah, it's her.
It's a three-hour cut of Zootopia.
Is her asking about the difference between the carrot 8 plus and whatever? Well, this one, the camera's a little bit better and it's more expensive. Okay, the howling I have to ask about. Judy, our corrupt cop who should have been fired and put behind bars, starts a howl with these timber wolves, which means she howls, it makes a timber wolf howl, and then a bunch of them howl. So why do they do that?
Well, normally wolves would howl because they disperse. They're like a big group of related or friendly individuals that form a group. Mm. And they'll disperse during the day to go hunting. Some hunt over here, some hunt over there, some are taking care of the young. And then usually in the evening, or early morning, where they'll howl to kind of communicate where each other is, and they can kind of convene, you know, reconvene together. Crows do this too. When you hear crows just sitting up there cawing, like caw, caw, caw on the branch, you're like, why is that crow just cawing? It's actually doing the same thing, because crows also have these what they fission-fusion groups. Like they'll fission off into their little groups of two or three, four crows or wolves, and they go off and do their own thing, foraging for food, and then they'll come back into big groups, fuse back into the big groups for the evening or something. And so certain types of animals like crows and wolves will do that. And that's the point of the howling, is to communicate over longer distances.
Got it. Okay. So it's like a tracker. It's like a geolocation move.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. And finally, you mentioned that lab where they're keeping some animals, and it just reminded me about animal testing. And I assume because the human species is monstrous, that that's still happening. Is that correct?
Is animal testing happening? Well, it depends on how you define animal testing. It is happening. I test animals. I have rats and pigeons at my lab at UCLA, and I study behavioral neuroscience types of questions with them. Then there's all the way to the idea of, like, you know, the perfume companies forcing rabbit eyes open and dropping drops. And, you know, so animal testing could be a lot of different things. People, I have a colleague who studies marmots in the wild in Colorado. He tags them, I believe, and then he just watches them for the most part and watches them, observes them naturally, and occasionally can do an actual experiment. Like you put a speaker up and you play a call and you see like an alarm call or something, and you can see how do the different individuals react. And so that's a form of animal testing. So that's a broad question.
Okay. Well, first of all, we already established that you're a monster. I would love to have your friend on the program because that guy sounds really interesting. And finally, yeah, I'm referring to the evil animal testing. I don't know what to call that exactly, but it's the animal testing of my nightmares.
What about feeding coffee to cats?
I mean,
is that in the realm of animal testing?
Yeah, great question.
That does seem cruel and unusual to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, to answer your question, I don't know a lot about all the history of that, but I do know that at university systems and at zoos as well, the regulations that govern the ethics of keeping animals in captivity and the kind of treatments we could do has gotten so much more oversight over the past 20, 30, 40 years. There's been a lot more since the 80s. There's been a lot more and a steadily increasing amount of oversight and concern and review of all procedures, all conditions under which animals that are kept in captivity for research purposes, for entertainment, which is zoos fall into that category, as well as research. A lot of research goes on at zoos as well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more oversight than there used to be. And so there's a lot less of the kind of unethical, in our view, mad scientist kind of tests done, or evil company that just wants to get their, make sure their perfume isn't going to destroy girls' eyes before they get it, or makeup before they get it out there on the market. There's a lot less animal testing in those situations, to my knowledge. Now, I don't know for sure if it's completely gone or what, but okay. There's a lot less.
Nobody you want to shout out right now and destroy, like, you don't have a fight with Ralph Lauren that you're currently, you know, in legal battles with?
No, I'm ignorant about what goes on in those places.
Okay, cool. Same. Well, listen, I really enjoyed speaking with you both. I loved this movie. I thank you both for watching it and for being on the program. Michael, I assume that you are back doing shows, so if there's anything you want to tell people about or how people can find you online, go ahead.
MichaelLongfellow.com. Definitely shows are back. Come see a show.
Excellent. I hope to do so. Blaze, something you want to tell people about? Let them know what's going on?
Oh, you mean with loop back to Ancestral Health? Or?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because that's coming up in 2 months. It's August 12th through 14th at UCLA. And if you Google Ancestral Health Society, you will find our website and information about the... It's a nonprofit, an educational not-for-profit registered here in California. Our mission is to get the message out about actually how our understanding of evolution and human evolution in particular can inform about human health and disease, and how we could live longer, healthier, happier lives. So we're having our 10-year anniversary event at UCLA.
Excellent. Well, I hope to see you there. I'm going to get crazy wasted and do a bunch of mushrooms and you know,
that's very ancestral.
Yeah, that's
parasites.
Do a bunch of parasites in my cat's poop and just go crazy watching these speeches, man. That sounds super fun. Yeah, thank you both once again, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye bye.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Bad Science is a Seeker podcast produced by Emily Feld and me, Ethan Edinburgh. The executive producer is Brett Kushner, and our social media is managed by Blue Whale Media. And please leave us an iTunes review. Give us 5 stars. I sound like an Uber driver, but it does help. It makes sure people know about the podcast, which we really appreciate. Thanks for listening. Bye.